Madam Marshall, will you please call the case?
Calling the case of Windcliff Association, Inc. versus Aaron Brayfogle et al. Court file number A210700.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We will conduct this hearing much like we would if we were in person. You each will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes of rebuttal for the appellant if you choose to use it. Please say your name at the beginning of the hearing because this is being recorded and will be posted on our website. And if at any time you can't hear us or there are technical difficulties, please raise your hand or wave your hand so that we can get those sorted through, and then we'll let you continue. So with that, is attorney for the appellant ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Good morning, my name is John Giesen. I represent the appellant, Windcliff Association. Windcliff is asking that this court reverse the district court and hold that the Brayfogles breached paragraph 1 and 16 of the Windcliff Declaration of Covenants. Paragraph 1 states that all such outbuildings shall have a maximum size of 1,200 square feet, and in parentheses then, as per Wabasha County zoning restriction, close parentheses. We are going to refer to that first part of paragraph 1 as the mandatory clause, the part that says all outbuildings shall have a maximum size of 1,200 square feet, and the second part, the clause that follows, is a parenthetical clause. Our position at the district court was that the mandatory clause is unambiguous. It contains mandatory language that provides for a maximum size of outbuildings in Windcliff of 1,200 square feet, and that the Brayfogles outbuilding, which exceeds 1,200 square feet, is in direct violation of paragraph 1. The narrow question here is whether the parenthetical clause operates as a condition subsequent or somehow defeats the application of the mandatory clause. And our interpretation, as we briefed, is that the mandatory clause is not defeated by the parenthetical clause. Rather, the essential part of paragraph 1 is what is outside of parentheses, and the non-essential information is what's found inside parentheses.
If I may, Mr. Gleason, but doesn't then the mandatory clause, as you termed it, render the parenthetical, a nullity, just obsolete? And doesn't that sort of reading and perhaps then you would say, well, but the respondent's reading renders the mandatory clause obsolete and doesn't, if you look at those, aren't they both, reasons that we should say this is ambiguous?
We respectfully disagree. We don't think that to give both clauses meaning, that means that both clauses have to have equal weight. Our position is that the part outside of parentheses has greater weight and is the main meaning of paragraph 1. And the part within parentheses, while not meaningless, has subsidiary meaning and operates, as the grammar suggests, as a citation, as a historical point of reference. And that is the proper meaning as indicated by the grammar. It's not that the parenthetical clause is meaningless, it's that its meaning is limited to its grammatical orientation in paragraph 1.
So, Mr. Giesen, what if the parenthetical clause said, so long as a larger building is prohibited by the Winona County ordinances, would you still make that argument that that clause within the parentheses does not affect the meaning of the first clause?
I think that may be a different case. I think I heard Your Honor say, as long as Wabasha County zoning restrictions still allow, was there a still in that?
Right.
I would say the word still in that instance would reference that.
Well, I didn't say still, but that was the same meaning. If it says so long as a larger building is prohibited by the Winona County zoning ordinances,
I think that would be a clear indication that Wabasha County zoning restrictions as amended would apply. But there's no indication in the parenthetical clause that Wabasha County zoning restrictions, plural, is what's to govern Windcliff outbuilding size.
What's the meaning of the words as per?
That's citation language. It's providing that the historical source of this 1,200 square foot cap is not pulled out of the air. It's as the declarant, Sylvia Brown, testified. It was selected because it was the original outbuilding size cap provided by the county. So it provides a reason. It's an explanation for why outbuilding size is capped at 1,200 square feet, but it does not say that the 1,200 square foot cap ceases to exist or that outbuilding size provided by the county as amended governs.
Do you think that the word per is sometimes used to have the same meaning as pursuant to?
I would agree with that.
And so
I think you could fairly say that. Oh, excuse me, Your Honor.
So if we read the paragraph one to say maximum size of 1,200 square feet pursuant to Washington County zoning restriction, then what?
I think you still run into the same point, is that this is a singular zoning restriction. It's the historical one in effect at the time the declaration was established. There's no indication that this zoning restriction that the parenthetical clause refers to is the one that's been in or now in effect. It's, again, as the grammatical structure indicates, it's a historical point of reference.
But then, Mr. Eason, to be able to construe this as kind of a matter of plain language, saying it's unambiguous, you would have us read the word historical into that, or 2003, as pursuant to the historical Wabasha County zoning restriction, or 2003, I think that was the year. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, it may be 2001 or 2003, I forget the exact. But
in other words, go ahead, Mr.
So I would say that you don't need to read in the word historical. I would say that the natural meaning of parenthesis as per Wabasha County zoning restriction and parenthesis plainly indicates that there's one zoning restriction in effect, and that's the one that was in effect at the time that the declaration was drafted. I don't think you need to add words. I think the result of not giving the parenthetical clause the weight that it grammatically deserves is that the mandatory clause is completely nullified. And that's what the result of the district court's analysis was, is that there's no weight given to the mandatory clause. The 1,200 square feet language, it's as if that appears in the parentheses. Frankly, that's just not how normal people use parentheses. People use parentheses to put aside information in, not the main point of the writing. And that's this, excuse me, Your Honor.
Just while we're talking about plain language reading, can we take that same plain language reading analysis and turn it to kind of another claim in this lawsuit relating to paragraph 16? Because it just strikes me, and tell me your reaction to this, that if we take your approach to, like, let's look at the plain meaning and apply it to paragraph 16, which refers to a written approval of the plans from the declarants. Well, the declarants here aren't your clients. So just as a matter of that plain reading, wouldn't we say that their summary judgment on that claim, we could agree, is appropriate?
Well, I think there's competing canons. There's not always one canon that provides the determinative outcome. I think the canon that needs to be kept in mind, especially with respect to 16, as well as paragraph one, is that you need to read things in context. And you can't read paragraph 16 in isolation from paragraph 20. And paragraph 20 expressly says that the declarants are no longer in control if they don't own land at Windcliff, which makes sense. You don't want outsiders ruling Windcliff. You know, it's kind of the reason why America was formed. We didn't want to be ruled by faraway leaders. And the district court essentially came to this outcome where Sylvia Brown, despite the fact that she no longer lives in Windcliff, her post-hack approval of the Breifogel's plans was sufficient approval under paragraph 16. And that's not consistent with paragraph 16 or 20 when we're together.
Mr. Giesen, though, when I look at the covenants, I don't see any authority in it or in case law to support your argument that the Windcliff Association is then substituted for declarants.
Your Honor, we pointed to the restatement of servitudes.
Yes, but that's persuasive, not binding authority, unless it's been adopted in Minnesota law, which it hasn't been.
I'd agree with that. We'd also point to the fact that the Breifogels agreed with our interpretation. And as a matter of practical construction, of paragraph 16 to 20, they submitted their plans to the association and only changed course when they got back a response they didn't like. That practical construction is at a minimum sufficient to defeat summary judgment. And we also just suggest that a statement of servitude is a very, and when there is no case law on this issue in Minnesota, which as far as my research shows, there isn't. I don't think the statement of servitude should be just dismissed. I don't think you need to follow it as binding authority, but I think it's worth considering. And I think the analysis behind it is sound and consistent with paragraph 20. So at a minimum, this court should hold that paragraph 16 does not require the Browns to continue to approve plans. That's inconsistent with the plain language, as well as the persuasive authority, as well as the practical construction that was shown prior to this litigation by the respondents.
So there's a difference, though, you would agree, between saying, well, the Browns shouldn't be applying the plans, as you know, and, as opposed to saying, but it should be your client instead, right? I mean,
yes.
We could say, okay, it's not the Browns, but then there may be, maybe we did say, and so no approval is required. Wouldn't that be fair?
I suppose you could hold that, but that would be inconsistent with the general authority or the general consensus of the law as stated in the restatement of servitudes, which we are arguing should be the law in Minnesota. And the fact that there is no case law on this point in Minnesota suggests that the restatement of servitudes is the best authority that this court has to look at. And clearly the restatement of servitude says that the association, after the developer is done, succeeds to the power that the developer once had. And that makes sense. The association should be in charge. The association is the democratically elected. It's the members voting for the members who they want to govern the affairs of Wincliff. So if the members of Wincliff want to have outbuildings of any size, they should take that to the next board meeting and elect new board members or pursue the amendment process to get that done. But it shouldn't be a matter of reaching out to the former declarant and having her draft an affidavit saying that this is her intent. And that's what the district court followed. And at a minimum, that result should be reversed. I'd like to just go back to paragraph one briefly, if I may. The respondents take a somewhat surprising position that the rules of grammar are arbitrary. And we just make the point that grammar is not arbitrary. Ignoring grammar is arbitrary. And we cited to the Pachnut case, it's a Supreme Court case, it's recent, which in turn cites from Justice Kagan's analysis that, look, it's plain language interpretation. You should apply the way ordinary people use punctuation. And we'd also cite it to Reading Law. It says no intelligent construction of a legal text can ignore punctuation. And we just stress that the court not ignore the rules regarding parentheses. It's undisputed that parentheses contain incidental information. And I think that's a critical point.
Is it true that parentheses always contain incidental information? In other words, I mean, if a writer chooses to include essential information in a parenthesis, should a court such as this one disregard the content, the language inside the parentheses solely because of the parentheses?
I would say that in addition to that, you have, and like I said earlier, there's not one rule or canon of construction that necessarily applies in every case. I mean, you have to use judgment and apply all the canons. So there is no bright line rule. We're not asking for a bright line rule that this court establish as if this court were the Chicago Manual style or something like that. Simply in this case, along with all the other considerations that we're arguing, including that any other construction renders the mandatory clause meaningless, taken together, applying these canons, there is no second reasonable interpretation. And finally, even if there were, and let's assuming for the sake of argument that paragraph one is ambiguous, just like to briefly touch on the point that doesn't mean that the district court gets to engage in fact-finding on summary judgment or as a matter of public policy, simply nullify the restrictive covenant. At a minimum, as we've cited this court's 1985 published City of Breezy Point case, it's a question of fact. We shouldn't have our day in court taken away simply because it's a restrictive covenant involved. We've cited other more recent unpublished cases, which again are, I think, very persuasive on this point, that the mere ambiguity does not defeat a restrictive covenant, even with the rule of construction from the Mission Covenant case. And finally, there has been no dispute. I think the district court conflated our cross motions for summary judgment as a waiver of the right to a trial. Respondents haven't disputed that that's not what we did. Our intent was not to give up our right in trial by bringing cross motions for summary judgment. It was simply to say that our position is that the language of paragraph one is clear. But in the event it's not, we still are entitled to our day in court. So for the reasons said here and the reasons in our brief, we respectfully ask this court to reverse and remand for a trial on the issue of the association's remedy.
Thank you, Mr. Giesen. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is attorney for respondents ready to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may then.
Great. Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Roth, and I represent the respondents, Aaron and Abby Brayfogel. And we are here to seek affirmation of the lower court's decision to dismiss the complaint in its entirety. And as you saw by the extensive briefing, there are several ways to get there. It's not just finding that the paragraph 1 or 16 is not ambiguous. If it's not ambiguous and the Brayfogels are in violation, they still have to prove remedy. Remedy is a often overlooked element in a lot of lawsuits, particularly these homeowner association lawsuits, where you have a lot of personalities involved, you have neighbor disputes, there is a lot of infighting. Infighting to the point where my clients have had to get restraining orders on individuals in the association. And that also has led to a lot of other issues that the Brayfogels are having to deal with. There's just simply no remedy. And if you look at the reply memorandum of law, it is not addressed at all, except for it's not required because it involves real property. And I know usually we start with the beginning and start with the ambiguity and work down, but I kind of want to start backward only because there was so much discussion already about the potential ambiguity or the actual ambiguity in the first covenant.
So you would ask, have us reach an issue that the district court didn't reach, right?
Correct. And as I, go ahead.
And my concern is, I mean, one, we try not to do that if possible, but also I just don't see the record here as being particularly well developed for us to be able to reach this issue. Maybe there was a reason the district court, another reason, didn't reach it. So could you address that concern of mine?
Yes, Your Honor. My position on that one is that the record has to be developed through discovery by the appellants. The appellants did not at all provide any evidence of irreparable harm in our discovery requests or in the depositions. The door has closed for that. My guess is because there is no irreparable harm, because nobody would give them an opinion that there is a decrease in value of the property. There is no claim of nuisance. There is no other evidence of irreparable harm that is necessary. So as I cited in our appellant brief, this court does have authority to reach issues that would have been a decision by the district court, if not actually addressed by the district court. And since this is a de novo review, this court is able to make that decision to determine if the appellants have met their burden of proof in this case on the remedy issue.
I have a question for you, Ms. Rolfe. The district court found that paragraph one was ambiguous, and all the case law that I've read makes that a fact question, which typically goes to a jury. Judges don't decide disputed facts. How do you respond to that?
I agree that that is the general rule, that if a court finds something ambiguous, that whether something's ambiguous is within the court's jurisdiction. And I believe that the appellant has also agreed with that. We agreed with it on summary judgment through the Court of Appeals. The issue is whether or not the district court judge had authority to decide as a matter of law how to interpret that ambiguity. And the case law that was provided by appellants is not applicable. It's talking about general rules of contract interpretation. There is a separate section of law that applies to restrictive covenants to use of land. And under that string of cases, which has been around for a lot longer than has been a law around almost just as long as these general rules of construction, is that if there's a land use restriction, not whether or not the restriction applies to a certain part of property or not, or what, not whether or not it interferes with somebody else's use of their property, like you build your, you know, your fence 2 feet onto someone's property. But if it has to do with the use of your own property, the published binding case law is still Mission Covenant. And that leads to a de facto determination by the district court judge that the restriction is not enforceable as a matter of law. And
so that's what I can just ask you about that case.
Yeah.
Because I see that as a little different than here, assuming, I mean, if we were to conclude that the restriction here was ambiguous. I mean, I just didn't read that case as saying the district court could construe an ambiguous term, and arguably there's an ambiguous term, at least in section one, as a matter of law, applying that rationale. Could you help me with that?
I believe Mission Covenant did, and it conclude as a matter of law that it should be restricted. And that was the procedural posture. And that's been the procedural posture ever since in these cases. The cases that have gone to appeal are issues where somebody is appealing the district court judge's ultimate decision to construe against the restriction in favor of free use of property. And then a lot of these appellate courts that I cited in my brief agreed that that should apply, with the exception of two unpublished decisions. The Brady decision didn't actually isn't really applicable because it addressed what property was encumbered by the restriction. And in fact, in Brady, I believe they specifically said this Mission Covenant doesn't apply because this doesn't involve use of someone's land. It's who is encumbered by that covenant. So by implication, that Court of Appeals unpublished decision was saying Mission Covenant is still good law. And then in the subsequent case that dealt with whether or not you can put two houses on one property or three houses on one property, and let me pull up the name of that one. It's like Krowiczyski or something. I'm probably butchering it. I know it starts with a K, and I don't know why I always want to go to Iski with it. It looks like Kosick. So I was, you know, pretty fairly close. The Kosick case, the one, it's not binding precedent. And it, two, it didn't explicitly overturn Mission Covenant. What it did is essentially kind of carve out an exception to Mission Covenant's rule in favor of free use. And they said, if the party seeking to enforce shows affirmative evidence that that developer intended the restriction. And in here, in that case, in Kosick, it was the developer advertised it as certain ways, actually told people things, wrote things down. There's affirmative evidence that that was the intended restriction, because the nature of that neighborhood was to only, they didn't want houses, they wanted bigger pieces of property and not as much housing on it. So the overall purpose of the community was also fulfilled. Here, if you look at the overall purpose of the covenants, it's not to restrict sizes, it's to maintain value. So in fact, they actually have minimum sizes for most of the buildings, and minimums, and not maximums. So allowing somebody to have a slightly larger garage doesn't fall afoul to the purpose of having a residential community, which is only, and also does, there is no affirmative evidence that has been provided. So the evidence that they quote are a few selective quotations from Miss Sylvia Brown's deposition that are completely taken out of context as shown by the district court, and as I outlined as well. And what in essence, Ms. Brown testified to is that this was her first time doing a development. And as you can see by a lot of the errors throughout the covenants in grammar and in language, even as admitted by Ms. Ackerman, who was on the board in her deposition, they're messy. They're a very messy document. She said that had she known that the zoning ordinance could change, she didn't know that they could change it, she wouldn't have put it in there. So that's what, maybe at one point she said, yes, it doesn't say exactly what appellant's counsel wanted it to say, which is unless it's changed by the zoning ordinance or all these other offered alternative language and alternative sentence structure that could have been used. She says that, yes, it doesn't say that specifically, but Ms. her Roth, intent.
I must say, as someone who, you know, sat down and read through the deposition of her deposition, which is, you know, taken after her affidavit was clear, you know, deposition, she was all over the map on some of these questions. You know, I mean, you're right. I mean, you quote parts of her deposition that support your position. Mr. Giesen quotes parts of her deposition that supports the appellant's position, but all that, and I just really like your reaction to this, just leads me to say, isn't this a question of fact that goes to the jury? Not to mention, I think that, and help me with this, there are some witnesses, you know, that appellant had, which arguably could also go to, you know, what was the intent, her intent, as it played out across the years.
First, I will say that the Mission Covenant, potential exception to Mission Covenant, that is the unpublished decision. So if you go that route, it's a affirmative burden, not just a issue of fact. They have to show affirmatively that that's what she meant. Her getting mixed up in some of her deposition testimony and later clarifying it is not enough to meet that burden or meet the evidentiary standard that Cossack allowed. Outside of Cossack, there is no exception to Mission Covenant. And Cossack is an unpublished decision that had very different fact pattern than our situation, had very different evidence than our situation. And the other individuals that they identified as having evidence, I deposed them. Absolutely none of them support the appellant. And that's probably why appellant didn't put it in their record on appeal here. The only evidence they have is about four quotes that are from Ms. Brown, that when you look at the entire context, when it's cleaned up by my colleague, one of my former partners, is not what it actually says. She admits that it doesn't have the exact language that appellants want, but that doesn't mean that that's what she intended. She states numerous times that she would not have put that in there if she knew the zoning ordinance would change, that she didn't want it to be absolute. And that is not enough for the appellants to overcome the long-standing principle. You want to talk about why the United States was created, freedom of property, freedom of use. That's why we have Mission Covenant. And that's why we have that Mission Covenant hasn't been touched since it was decided over 50 years ago, because the presumption is that you can use your property as you want, unless there is a clear, unambiguous restriction on it. That's the law. That is what the binding precedent is on this court. And that is what we argue as appellants should be followed. I want to touch before my time is up the grammar arguments. One, we never admitted that parentheticals are always common use citations. If you look closely at the cases they cite for that proposition, they refer to legal writing. And of course, in legal writing, we know that parentheses are normally citations. Ms. Brown wasn't a lawyer. She didn't have a lawyer write this. And then the other cases that are cited are purely addressing statutory canons of construction. And there are over a dozen statutes that instruct the legislatures how to write and how something is going to be interpreted. There's no such key or no such, you know, decoding device. I mean, if only we had one of those rings that you could, you know, put over it and, you know, like my six-year-old has, and it shows what it really means. We don't have that here. And with the amount of discourse that we've had through this whole case and then just the arguments here, I think it's pretty clear that paragraph one is ambiguous. I think it's really unclear what that parenthetical meant. Under legal writing, it means one thing. Under lay person writing, it could mean another. That's why we have the canons of construction that follow ambiguity. And I would like to point out, I believe that almost every case that appellant cited, the court found an ambiguity. It's not a really high standard to find an ambiguity. It's then you leave it to, this isn't a case for a jury anyway. If it gets remanded, that'll be addressed. But go ahead, Your Honor.
Ms. Roth, if I may, I think one of appellant's arguments, I'm sure he'll correct me if I'm wrong, is that if you look at that parenthetical, the only reason it becomes ambiguous is if you look at extrinsic evidence of the fact that the zoning law did later change. And that's not what we do, like kind of a plain language analysis, looking at that extrinsic evidence. Would you address that for me?
Yeah, I disagree that that's extrinsic evidence. I think that that is, as I pointed out in my brief, the context in which the ambiguity arises. So before 2015, the Zoning Commission would never have given anybody a permit for an outbuilding over 1,200 square feet. So there was no need to ever go back and look at the covenants to see what the covenants permitted. In 2015, when the repeal happened and the Breyfogles went to go get their permit and saw that there was no restriction, they looked at the covenants to see if there was a restriction and interpreted it as that restriction was no longer valid as it has been changed in the Zoning Commission itself. So that's the way I look at that. I think extrinsic evidence would have been considering the testimony or the affidavits or the emails of Ms. Brown and coming to a decision. I think the context is really important because otherwise it would be a moot point. We wouldn't even be here, you know, before 2015 because there would be no judiciable issue, you know, because the Zoning Commission doesn't allow it. So who cares if the covenant allows it or not?
Thank you, Your Honor. Roth. Mr. Giesen, any rebuttal?
Just briefly, Your Honor. First, I'd like to touch on the irreparable harm argument. Just briefly state that the restraining orders she referenced are nowhere in the record. And second, that we did address that there is irreparable harm. Irreparable harm is damages that money won't fix, and decision to violate a restrictive covenant is irreparable harm. Money damages aren't going to fix the Breyfogles' violation of paragraphs 1 and 16. Second,
but your complaint also does request at least $50,000 in damages.
And that's correct. We pointed that out. There's been no determination by the district court as to other available remedies, and we're reserving the right to seek all of those damages, attorney's fees, et cetera, that are requested in our complaint. And second, I just want to touch briefly on the Mission Covenant discussion. And I just wanted to quote or read the Supreme Court's 1916 case that I cited. Quote, if the rule stated by counsel means that whenever the language of the restriction is such as to suggest doubt, either slight or grave, as to the meaning or extent of the alleged restriction, the court must forthwith forbear further consideration of the case and deny relief, then we do not concur. I mean, this has been the law going back 100 years and going back, like, that's probably about 6 months now in the Cossack case. Just the law is not that ambiguities can be construed as a matter of law simply because of restrictive covenants involved. Third, I want to touch on Brown's testimony. There's been no discussion at all of Brown's testimony that she agreed at the beginning of her deposition that respondents built an outbuilding somewhat larger than the covenants allowed. That's direct evidence in our favor, and that's in complete agreement with us. Fourth, I wanted to address the distinction between a legal writing versus lay writing. This is legal writing. This is a legal document that's being interpreted. I think we made the point in our brief, this isn't poetry. This isn't as if grammar should be ignored because somebody who is trying to be expressive rather than clear is the author. This was a legal document which should be interpreted as legal documents are generally interpreted. Finally, the extrinsic evidence discussion. I want to point that the county zoning change is extrinsic evidence. It is not something that's found within the four corners of the declaration. It's an outside fact. If you're going to consider that, there needs to be an ambiguity found in the text first. Again, the text decides whether the text is ambiguous. You don't get to use outside facts to find ambiguities to then open up to all these other testimony that's maybe relevant on point.
Well, what if the document itself refers to some other source? You know, in a sense, you know, does that essentially incorporate it by reference? And in that case, is it still considered extrinsic?
You're going to have to think about that for a second.
I'm thinking too. I'm not sure, but it's an interesting question.
I don't think it does. I think, you know, if it had incorporated by reference, you may have a different question. As per Wabasha County zoning restriction, I go back to my original point that functions as a citation, not as an incorporation by reference. There's language that could have been used to incorporate it by reference. And in fact, if you look at Brown's deposition testimony, she said she wished she had put that language in retrospect. We're simply asking this court to not go by unexpressed subjective intent that people wish in hindsight that they should have put in. Just go by what's written. You can't use outside facts, such as a county zoning change in 2007. It's not found in the text to determine that the text is ambiguous. I think if those normal rules construction are applied, the association's motion for partial summary judgment should have been granted, but at a minimum, the cross motion for summary judgment from the Breyfogles should not have been granted. And that at a minimum, there's material disputes, a fact that prevent summary judgment. And unless the court has further questions, we just ask this court to reverse.
Judges Jessen or Johnson, any more questions? Thank you very much. It's a very interesting case and was well briefed and well argued, and we'll have our decision out within within the 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you, Mr. Giesen.